Okay.
See, when the First World War started, I was only 12 years old. And the town we lived in had a huge railroad station. It was sort of the middle between Eastern Russia and Western Russia. It starts north. That was the biggest railroad station.
It was in the wheat industry.
Before Kiev, before the Dnepr, the biggest lakes, like we have here the five lakes, and there's the Dnepr. So the railroad was the biggest station where I come from. And there was an ammunition dump that supplied all the ammunition for the Eastern War, for the war from Eastern Russia into Austria, Germany, Hungary, and all those Balkan countries. And we used to have 100, 120, 110 trains a day passing by. And every time a train stopped, which must have been 25 to 40 cars in each one, they came down to the town for food and for clothing. And the sick ones had to be attended. Well, by the time I was 14 years old, I was drafted to go to those trains with wounded soldiers and bandage them, bring them a drink, bring them a package of cigarettes, or sit with them until they die and read a story to them. The girls were drafted from 14 years of age up. And after all that chaos for 5 years, the revolution broke out in the Western Russia. Western and northern part of Russia. And we were quite a ways from them. But as the war finished, bandits formed, organized these army deserters, or when the war finished, the soldiers went home from the army. They took the ammunition and clothing with them. And as I said, the now big railroad station, our town, everybody dropped in there. And they came to the population of the town. They robbed everything from A to Z. They took off your shoes, your nightgowns.
Were these deserters?
They needed stuff. They were not...
They had no relief. They had no welfare.
The war was ended. They were loose.
They had nothing.
Then the revolution broke out. They had no government. They had nobody to go there and claim it to. I was married to a man later when I was 19 years old. He had a bullet wound saving from the war. He had nobody to claim to for a dime. He couldn't get free medication, he couldn't get anything. And he struggled his own way, and that's the way most of the army was. And there were millions of them. They came down to these towns and they robbed us, they robbed the blood out of us. The farmers did not come to the markets, they didn't want to plant. Eventually, after 5, 6, 7 years lapsed, they didn't want to plant because they brought it up to the markets, the soldiers took it for nothing. So their farmers were staying home. If anybody planted wheat or potatoes or whatever they had, or beans, they kept it in their basements or in their attics. And if you wanted some food, you had to walk to the farmland, exchange for clothing if you had any left. Or for boots in Russia, you know, the mud part, the mud is so soft and so thick. You had to have boots all year round. You couldn't get no food. You couldn't get a 5-pound package of flour unless you gave them some different stuff in return. Salt, sugar,
When you were on the farm, what kinds of things did you exchange in order to eat?
Well, that's what we exchanged for beans. Mostly there was beans.
No, her father was a businessman.
My father was was a tailor of 4 years. He was running a...
In Russia, he'd wear a lot of furs.
He was running a factory. He had 4 or 5 men working with him. And he wouldn't accept any work unless they gave him food in exchange.
Money had no value.
Money had no value because every bandit organized a couple of thousand men. They went into the ammunition dumps. Everything was open. There was no control of any kind. They got themselves ammunition, clothing. They went robbing. They knew where the banks were, they knew where the gold was stored, they knew where the wealthy people used to live. They robbed everything from basement to the roof. And they took it for themselves. If you didn't like them, you got killed. I know there was one bandit, his name was Petlura, he came to my our town at night. He brought in 400 peasants, farmers. All he had to tell them is, if you come with me and fight, I'll give you ammunition, and eventually you'll get land and freedom. So they followed him. When he dressed them up and gave them guns in their hands, they ran all over town, they took whatever they wanted. They raped, they robbed, they killed. 44 people and one day was killed.
In your village?
Yeah.
Rose said that her mother used to hide them when any of the
soldiers were. Myself and my sister was about 15, and I was about 17 at the time. Gentile people, they were friends with us from years back. They hid us so the soldiers shouldn't rape us or kill us. My mother stayed in the kitchen, and she had aluminum washtubs, you know, great big washtubs, being a set. She'd
galvanized.
She'd cook in there for the soldiers. They'd come in there, they in the front of the house, they established a telephone office, and they came in and they brought a half a cow, who knows where they got cooked. She stood there and she cooked the food for them. And they took off their filthy, dirty clothes and she had to wash it in the same galvanized tub. And this is the baby lived 4 years after the war. By killing and robbing and raping and not sleeping at home and not ever, you were afraid to get out in the morning. Because the same soldiers that were parked in my father's home came to my mother in the kitchen and were demanding the girls. I saw the girl. I saw the girl. There is the girl. He beat over the gun. There is the girl. She says, I have no girls. You see, I have no girls. Only three little boys.
Oh, she hid you?
So she was at a neighbor's.
Yeah, the neighbors hid us.
Gentile neighbors.
One day he got up in the morning, there was some shooting going on. He walked up in the street and the ammunition dump exploded. Not the ammunition dump, a train that was loaded exploded. And the whole town was almost broken down. Every house collapsed. People were running like mice. And they talked to one another, we have to run at least 40 miles from here. Because the train near the ammunition dump exploded. If that hits the ammunition dump, the whole town is going to go upside down. The most treacherous time, I can tell you, I remember from Europe.
And then how you got out.
And we had no government control.
See, her
that
daughter,
control us.
Her daughter was born in Russia.
Yeah, the government, there was no government to control anything. Because anyone, any bandit, anyone who could ride a horse, put himself on the horse and he said, he's the leader, he's a general. If you follow me, you get freedom and land.
That was the revolution.
And so people believe?
Yeah, but there was no revolution in Eastern Russia. The revolution was going down in the front.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the west and in the north.
Mm-hmm. This was just the fringes of it.
There was east of Kiev, east of the Dnepr.
Rose came from Kiev.
Yeah. See, this was east of Kiev. See, like here you say, east of the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
Chicago's Middle West.
Yeah.
We were from the eastern part of Russia.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The revolution didn't reach there until 1920-21.
Oh, uh-huh.
Then the German army came into our part of the country to establish order. Then they had some kind of a revolution in 1920.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany, they went home, they left everything powerless. There was no office, no policeman, nobody to talk to. Anybody could come in and kill you. That was it. Well, my husband, he was a refugee from the army, but originally he was born and raised in Poland. And Then things quieted down a little in Hetman. He was a Ukrainian priest, but he was also in his young days in the army, and he was a general. And he took control of the Ukraine, of the part of Russia that I come from. And he got to Kiev with an army, let's say 5,000 or 10,000 people, and he proclaimed himself as the leader of the Ukraine. Eventually, after the Germans left, the Polish army came in to occupy the Ukraine. Everybody wanted to grab the land and the power. And the Bolsheviks were not here. They were in a different part of the country. They bled up there. They couldn't come here.
That's what they call white Russia.
Yeah, they didn't come to Eastern Russia until the 1920s.
Well, Russia had to be changed, you know.
Yeah. So then the Polish army came in. My husband was born and raised in the Polish faction of Europe, you know. At that time, when he was born and raised, Poland belonged to Russia, to the Tsar. It was a colony of the Russians. So he was like a Russian citizen. But during the war, they grafted everybody all over the country in colonies and everything. So after the Polish army came in, proclaimed itself, they're going to make order on the Ukraine, he came to the army office, my husband, and he said, well, I'm a Polish citizen. I was born and raised in Poland. He had his documents. He says, I want to go back home. So he took me and the baby, and we went by a refugee train. We traveled from my town to Warsaw, which you could originally go by train in 3 days. It was like from here to California or something like that, in the slow times, you know. Now, we traveled 7 weeks. Wherever the train,
with that baby.
Wherever the train pulled in, of course, they were stacked away on the bed.
And through all that.
And the army and the soldiers were kind of going first in the trains. The refugee train was standing there. Don't you think I was attacked in the train? And don't think, and my husband, there was a few men among the refugees. My husband was holding the baby, and he said, crawl into the sack. There the sacks are bigger than here, you know, and the weight is different there. I crawled into the sack, and he sat down on top of me. The baby. And the soldiers came in, they looked for the women. So he said, I have no woman, I just had the baby. My woman died, was sitting on top of me. So he saved me.
Imagine going through all that, and that's the shock you could.
We came to Poland. The Polish army was still in the Ukraine. And when he came there, they grafted him into the army, go back and find the Russians in the Ukraine. I was left here with the baby like nothing. I was standing in the street, I didn't know which way I was looking or going or doing anything. One couple had two children of their own, a girl of 15 and a boy of 12. They took me into the house with the baby. I had nothing, I had nobody. He was gone to the army.
Well, did you ever get connected up again with him?
Well, it took, the Hetman army chased everybody out of the Ukraine. The Polish army, the German army, they pushed everybody out. They organized very strongly. He was a priest and he was an evangelist priest. And he took a hold of the Ukraine and he got powerful. So when the Polish army came back to Poland, they freed my husband. And he went looking for me. He found me. I was in the same town. These people that took me in with the baby knew his parents from the way back. Well, he found me and then we traveled here, you know. But by the time I left Russia with the refugee train, I have gone through with the experience of 13 changes of government. 13 changes of government. Each general or bandit, whoever he was, declared himself a leader, had printed money, gave out orders, confiscated everything there was anything to be confiscated, and then down they went. They fought one another. And in between, mostly, there were a lot of Gentile people killed. A lot of peasants were killed. I can't say no. But mostly, the Jewish population was ruined. Because every one of the armies came to the Jewish population.
Well, they were, the Christians were always anti-Semitic, you know.
Well, anyway.
When you say that you witnessed like 13 changes of government, how large an area was that? Like, was that in the
Ukraine?
Uh-huh.
The Ukraine is quite a large area.
That's the agricultural part of Russia.
The all agricultural part of Russia.
Yes, especially wheat. That's their breadbasket.
The eastern capital.
Isn't that down near the Black Sea or somewhere?
No. The Black Sea is Crimea.
Oh.
Like you say, here, Florida or California.
Oh, yeah, I know it's a resort.
Yeah, Crimea.
It's in a warm
area. The Persian part.
Oh, yeah.
Close to the Persian part of Russia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the Black Sea.
Mm-hmm.
But we were near the Dnieper.
Oh.
The Dnieper is like here, the Lake Ural,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lake Superior, you know.
Yeah, in the inner Russia.
Because the Dnieper and the Bug and the Vaisal, it's three. Forgot already.
Mm-hmm.
A long time since I'm here, I've been there.
Yeah.
54 years.
Was there any kind of a daily routine or a daily life for you there during all that time? Were you going to school?
Altogether,
or were you?
There was no such thing. There was no for civilians, there was no trains running, there was no library, everything was destroyed. There was no schools. After Edmund took power, it opened up a little. In other words, they had a great school going, they had a high school going, that's where my father, mother and five more children were left there, after I left with my husband. They were 4 years longer in there. But they had small children, and
Rose was their oldest daughter.
My father had his own home, so his children were admitted. There was no Bolshevik or communist schooling there at all. Not until the 1928 or 29 they took over from Hetman. But Hetman was a democratic system, like, but he was the one who took over after the war chaos. And the first break up of pogroms and all that misery, you know.
You know what a pogrom is, don't you?
There was no everyday life. There was no ever. How can there be everyday life when a sick soldier comes in and he breaks a half a cow of meat, a pile of meat, and he tells her stay and cook, and then he tells her wash my pants. So there was nobody to say no. You were afraid of them. They had the guns. Complete chaos. All civilized life was dumped.
You know, I talked, we had a friend that came after the revolution here, not long after.
That's long.
In 19, I don't know where she was from, but her father had a shoe factory in Russia. And she was well educated. She was Jewish. And she told me, that you know, but that was after the revolution. Right after.
And mostly factories. I want to stop you for a second.
It's okay.
Mostly factories in the developed industry of any kind was not in the Ukraine.
Well, I don't know.
We were strictly the breadbasket country.
Yeah, well, I don't know which one, but she was in the industrialized part.
Latvia.
I don't remember.
White Russia. And Northern Russia, that was Siberia, White Russia, and Latvia. That was they had more industry. That was even before the war.
Uh-huh.
That was the industrial part of Russia.
Well, and she was well educated because she spoke good English, kind of a broken, but
yeah,
good. And we worked together, and it was a lovely character. And she said that in Russia, some part, there were so many different kinds of people lived in Russia, you know, and she said so many couldn't even, they just grunted for language. You know, they didn't have no alphabet, they had no language, they couldn't write their name.
So she must come from Western Russia.
Somewhere.
Because there were a lot of
one day I was fighting with the boss, one of the best bosses I ever had, And she called me over, and he couldn't hardly read and write, but he could make a pattern, he could design a garment, but he couldn't write his name hardly. And I was fighting with him, but in the meantime, he was working for a fella, and they must have been working on a percentage or something. So one day he called me over, and he said, "Eddie, would you go in business with me?" I said, "Why, no, you know you and I fight all the time." And he says, "But listen," he says, "I know I'm a dumb person, but," he says, "look what this SBA has done to me." He took a piece of brown paper there. He said, he told me that they made so much last year and this year and the losses and all, and he said, "This part is yours." And he says, "I can't live on that." I said, "Well, that's dirty." Then I turned on it. And I was,
was he a refugee too?
Well, no, he'd been in this country a while because he could. And he said one of the salesmen and him were going to go in business together. I said, "Well, I'll go." I said, "I don't want to work for him then if he's that kind." He says, "Well, will you work for me?" I said, "Yes, I'll go work for you." And he said, "But I ain't got no money to pay no money." And I loaned him a couple of hundred. I said, "Well, I'll loan you a couple of hundred." And I loaned him a couple of hundred dollars. And we were down there making the samples and getting the salesman out. Only had one salesman, and we were getting him out. And his wife called up one morning. He says, "Eddie, can you get that line out?" Because he said, "Mr. Gross is pneumonia." And you know, pneumonia that day, they didn't have penicillin or nothing. And I said, "Well, we'll try." And the cutter was a refugee. He couldn't hardly talk English. But he cut him, and we got the line out, and we got the salesman out. About a week, we got him out. But one day, him and I were fighting, and this Leona said, called me and says, "Eddie, don't fight like that with Mr. Gross. You know that where he come from in Russia, they can't write their name." And she says, "He's got a wonderful mind. He may be dumb in one thing, but one thing he's not dumb on. He was a human being, you know." And so, you know, and she kind of shamed me. And that's what she said. She said, "And a lot of, they had to develop an alphabet so they could teach these people."
Don't you see, in Russia, there was not enough schools. Nobody was brought to there, except the industrialized state.
Well, Leona had went to school.
They had colleges, they had high schools.
She was well educated.
But not where I come from, the Ukraine. The Jewish families, Jewish parents, would send their children to a Hebrew rabbi to learn Hebrew prayers and history, and they would hire a Christian woman or man who was teaching the Russian language. Privately, there was no such thing as schools. But if you owned a home and you were a taxpayer, you could send two children to the state school.
Can you imagine?
There was one state school.
Limited.
In our town, because of this railroad station with a lot of railroad employees and families, so there was a state school in our town. But you couldn't go there unless you owned property. Now, my father had 8, 9 children growing up. Only two could go to school.
Can you read that?
My sister from New York and one of my brothers that lives here, they went to school. Sure, when they got here, they were only 17. They knew French, German, and English, and Latin, if you please. My sister in New York, she knew Hebrew enough to teach Hebrew.
Yeah.
That was private teaching.
That was from the private.
Private teachers. Otherwise, there was no school. Everybody was illiterate.
But when
the Jewish people
in the South,
they held on.
In here, in the South, they had no schools when I went to school.
The Jewish people held on to their history because they had rabbis, and they were teaching their children.
My birth was never recorded. None of our family births were recorded. They didn't have no registration for births in the South where we were born. I had to get a birth certificate before my mother died.
We had the registration, all right.
Well, we didn't in the South.
Absolutely.
People have no idea how the South runs. The people that live up here.
In this country, sure. But Russia was completely backward. That's why the population went revolutionary. Because there were a few leaders. The leaders would stand up on a bell or on a box and speak to them and promise them all the goodies if you go in the army, build a new army and fight for new existence. They followed them because they themselves didn't know what was talked about. They didn't
The peasants,
no papers, no printing.
The peasantry, the peasants of the Ukraine couldn't even speak Russian.
Well, that's what Leona said.
They spoke Slavic.
Well, she
Slavic.
Said, and she said
the Slavic language was very much spread because of the churches. They'd go and they pray in the Slavic language. And they didn't know about the right Russian language from the West or North. But when the generals in the army, they learned a few things to understand. The generals proclaimed to them freedom and land. They weren't killing. They went, they built a new army and they were fighting one another.
And the old regime had become so broken down and deteriorated.
There was nobody.
The Tsar and all that, they were all half-wits, you know. They were none of it had intermarried so much, but they weren't intelligent.
They were as bad as any other capitalist.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And so that's why, you know, when the revolution was and they really won, you know, they didn't let nobody live but the Tsar's family. They said that one girl still survived, but I doubt that was the girl. They killed the whole family one time.
They took them out on the flanks of wood and they killed them in the house.
Yeah. They said they didn't
know. I was still there.
Yeah, they didn't
want
one. They didn't want one left.
No,
there's
nobody left.
They said if there was one left, they was afraid of power, you know, of that power from that.
I have to make a telephone call, ladies.
Okay.